Data privacy gets real important when a computer can read your brain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino. The field of brain-computer interfaces, or BCIs, is quickly advancing. Elon Musk's Neuralink got FDA approval last month to begin testing brain implants in humans, and rival Paradromics is further along. Neurotechnology could be revolutionary for, say, people with severe paralysis, but it comes with ethical concerns, says Sarah Gearing, a philosophy professor at the University of Washington.
I think it's really promising technology, and there's a lot of good that could come from it. But it is also giving us access into a very intimate sphere of our functioning that I think we want to be very careful to protect. So privacy is a huge kind of concern here. Sometimes when I talk about privacy, people will say, well, but I'm not concerned about privacy because I have nothing to hide. But it's not really that we have guilty and non-guilty people or, you know, people who want to hide something. I think controls around privacy are the way that we manage our intimacy and who we let into our, you know, most personal ideas and thoughts and feelings and who we keep at arm's distance or who is a complete stranger. And I think being able to exercise agency over that is really important for our sense of ourselves as individuals. And I think putting electrodes into our brains in ways that allow us to record can be good when we want to share, as with somebody with a locked-in syndrome who would be able to express themselves to family members. But it also opens up this opportunity to collect other data. You know, this is the market of the internet, that there's a way to collect our data and monetize it and make use of it. And I guess this is where I would worry, that I think I want to put up protections around that very sensitive space. And even if it's not mind reading per se, now we want to be careful about the broad neural data that we collect because it can become more interpretable over time.
This technology is attracting a lot of investment right now. What are the implications of mixing this very sensitive space with potentially profit incentives?
On the one hand, when it's done to enable well-being and help people who have significant challenges to things that are really important for humans, like communication with our loved ones, that seems really, it's a good use of this. I think imagining the kinds of marketing that could happen based not on what I click and search on the internet, but now what I'm thinking seems very distressing. I also think our brains are really not us, not the same as our identity, but very central to our sense of ourselves and our consciousness. And if there can be, let's say, stimulation into the brain, there are ways that we know from deep brain stimulation studies that people's behavior can change a little bit. They can become more impulsive. They can become hypomanic. And when that happens, interestingly, the individual doesn't always recognize it about themselves. And so I think we want to be really careful about forms of control when we know that there's a profit motive behind an investment, right? In ways that you might be able to direct people to particular kinds of purchasing behavior, let's say.
So what kinds of protections are you talking about?
One thing is just being much more careful about how people opt into sharing data. And then on the other end of it, I have been a little bit involved with these groups thinking about a human rights approach to trying to preserve this privacy. It doesn't mean that the devices couldn't move forward when they're beneficial, but it provides a pushback for individuals if they feel they've been violated.
Are there ethical concerns that come up specifically in this context of testing this kind of technology?
I think people generally do a very good job of running studies, but I think there are underexplored parts of this. And one of them in particular that's been of a lot of interest at the NIH recently is thinking about what happens when the study ends. So you have an implantable device, it's in your brain, explanting it requires another brain surgery. But if it's been working for you, of course you would want to keep it. And keeping it might be one thing, but then you also need the upkeep of it, because it's a device, right? Electrodes fail or wires go bad, or, you know, there might need to be maintenance. And that's a very technical kind of maintenance. So not just any old physician or neurologist can perform that sort of function. And so there's now been a big conversation at the NIH and nationally or internationally, really, about what we call post-trial obligations. You know, what is the extent of them? How do you try to secure them? What counts as enough of a benefit that you would be permitted to keep the device?
And in your research, you have spoken to people who use BCI technology. I mean, what kinds of things have they told you about their experiences?
Yeah, so, I think these are some really cool people who are first in human, willing to be pioneers in this area. They put in a lot of time in the lab to try to learn how to use a device to control a robotic arm or a cursor or what have you, play a video game with it. And in our first grant study, we really asked them about their sense of agency in using the device. And that seems very central to who we are as human beings. You know, we want to be able to feel that we're doing something, to be responsible for that, to trust the action. You know, I trust my body that I can move in certain ways. If I'm moving with the help of a brain-computer interface, I want to be able to trust that it's reliable and will do the things that I want it to do, but also if it's giving me feedback. So some of the devices are trying to do both read out and write in, where some of the writing in would be sensory information. You know, if I have a robotic arm, engineers can put sensors at the end of the fingertip. So now I'm not only looking at the arm reaching, but I can feel pressure when I, you know, hold on to a coffee mug or something like that. But which is great, because then it will feel much more true to typical human experience when I'm using that device. But then if we have access to stimulate particular percepts in the brain, in the sensory cortex, that is how our external world is made, right? That's how we get access to what we think is out there in the world. And so that opens up this really interesting possibility of not trusting what's coming in. Some of the people we've talked to, when they're using it, will say things around responsibility, like this thing, it's pulling down and to the left. And you think, what is it pulling on? Because there's no, you're not holding anything. You're not using your muscles, right? Somehow it's pulling in your brain. Or we've talked to people who will say, when it's working really well, when the tuning is good, I feel like I'm in control and I am responsible for the movement of the cursor on the screen. But then other times, and it's not always clear what causes this, I feel like I'm fighting against it. It's one thing if we're fighting against a computer. If we're fighting against a computer that's inside of our brains, it can be hard to know who we are. Like, are we now combined with the device, or is it something separate from us that we push back against? And another really interesting thing we've heard from people in BCI studies is that the concentration part is tiring if you're in the lab for a few hours running these experiments, but that also their muscles feel tired and they're not moving the muscles. So I just think it's fascinating to learn more about our experience of agency by talking with people who are first in human studies in these device studies.
Sarah Gearing at the University of Washington. If you'd like to learn more about the ethical and human rights issues with neurotechnology, Sarah contributed to a paper that was recently published by the Cambridge Quarterly of Healthcare Ethics, which lays a lot of them out. I mentioned Neuralink and Paradromics, two of the leading companies in what the Washington Post reported has turned into a bit of an arms race since Neuralink launched just 6 years ago. The Post reports that 42 people around the world have used BCI implants in clinical trials, including one Pennsylvania man who last summer set a record by wearing his BCI implant for over 7 years. And closer to home, our producer, Daniel Shin, tried out a piece of non-invasive BCI technology last fall. He visited AE Studio in Los Angeles, where he was fitted with an external neural net to play a computer game using only his mind. It's pretty impressive. We've got a link to his reporting and a video of that demo at our website, marketplacetech.org. Rosie Hughes produced this episode. Jesus Alvarado and Daniel Shin also produce our show. Becca Weinman is our engineer. Daisy Palacios is the interim senior producer. Kelly Silvera is our executive producer. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino, and that's Marketplace Tech. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? Don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.